I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. The distinguished novelist Michael Crummy joins me again. His latest novel, The Innocents, has just been published. The reviews have already been good, lauding the book for the sweeping and wrenching story of a brother and sister living alone in a cove on Newfoundland's northern coastline. I talked to Mr. Crummy about siblings, about family, about his writing of the past. I asked him about Newfoundland and how he views the natural world. Michael Crummy's books include River Thieves, The Wreckage, and Galore, which he was on this program with back in 2009. Those books, as well as his most recent, Sweetland, have been finalists for major prizes like the Giller, the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, the Governor General's Literary Award, and other prizes. He lives in St. John's, Newfoundland, but joined me from Toronto last month. The Innocents is published by Doubleday and has since been longlisted for the 2019 Scotiabank Giller Prize. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Michael Crummy. Mr. Crummy, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So, as I was telling you, I'm not even halfway through the book yet. So would it be impertinent for me to ask you how long we follow Everett and Ada to the end of the book, say?
No, it wouldn't. I don't think it would be impertinent at all. In fact, I've kind of been giving away the ending in most of the interviews. Just because the ending was kind of the start for me. But I won't do that because you haven't finished the book. So, but they're around 17 and 15 when the book ends.
And these are years in which one grows up, and they're, you know, I'm older than that. I'm 37, but I mean, I remember, you know, just how tough they were,
right,
for anybody. And it's the worst time, isn't it, for someone to grow up, because a lot of the development that one needs, I guess, in those years, they just don't have, right?
Right.
And I guess it's like that, whatever era one grows up in, right? Especially this is in the 1800s, and yet, you know, they've got all kinds of problems, if you will.
Yeah.
Let alone growing up and developing who they are and their relationship with one another. I mean, that's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that this is based on a very small notice that I found about two orphaned siblings, mm-hmm. brother and sister, from around that time, and who were living alone in an isolated cove. And I think the reason I wasn't able to forget them, they stayed with me for years before I tried to write this book, was because I was thinking about my own childhood and how absolutely dumbfoundingly confusing it was moving from childhood through adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in a situation where I had some resources, where I had some things to turn to, you know. So I had supportive parents. There was a sex education class at school. You know, we all hung out at the dump and would come across abandoned skin mags. There were all sorts of little puzzle pieces we could use to try and figure out what was happening to us and what it meant for us. And even with that, with those puzzle pieces to work with, it was still, I was completely out of my depth, and I didn't know what the hell was going on, or how to be in the world with the changes that were happening to me.
Right.
You know, that was such a long, slow process of trying to make peace with this new part of me, which almost felt as if it had entered me from the outside and was not, I knew it was me, but it felt like a strange creature. And, yeah, so I was thinking, what would it have been like for these two youngsters who are sort of left on their own with nothing to turn to whatsoever? And how would they make sense of what was happening to them as they move from childhood through adolescence?
Yeah, you mentioned this anecdote that you came across. It was, I guess, in the process of research, you'd seen it. I guess, was it a diary that it mentioned this?
Yeah, no, I can't even remember. It was like just a one-paragraph notice office, so I think it was probably like a newspaper or a journal or something like that. But I didn't even write it down. I don't think I could find it now if my life depended on it. And it was just this one paragraph description of a clergyman happening upon these two orphans.
And so they live in this cove. It's awfully isolating. What did they do to fill that cove with the life that they lead? I mean, what is it for people listening to us? How do they spend their days?
Well, I'm mostly just trying to survive, and that would have been the life they led there while their parents were alive as well, I think. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to give a sense of the round of the seasons in that part of the world and how all-consuming it is in each of those different seasons to catch or put up enough material and supplies to avoid perishing, basically. And at the same time, trying to catch enough fish that they can trade for goods and supplies when the ship, the Hope, shows up twice a year. Because, of course, my wife has a real bugaboo about this 10-mile diet thing.
Right.
She said if people followed the 10-mile diet in Newfoundland, we would all die of scurvy. And so from the time Europeans first arrived, they were absolutely dependent on things brought in from the outside. So the way that the fishing families worked is that they caught fish. They got supplies on credit from a merchant on condition that they give all of the fish at the end of the season to the merchant in payment for those supplies. It was a credit system.
Right.
So the children, of course, are left, just the two of them, to try and catch and cure enough fish to get supplies in to keep them from perishing through the winter. And that's more or less how they spend all of their time when they're not dealing with, shipwrecks washing up on shore or storms that threaten to basically take them out to sea and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't have siblings. I'm an only child. And so I found it fascinating reading about this relationship that the two siblings have. The connection that they have, I mean, that's unique in and of itself. How does that relationship between Everett and Ada, how does that evolve?
Well, when the book starts, I think they almost don't differentiate between one another. I think there's one point where it says they're as close as the rind on a tree. And, I mean, they know that there are differences in the terms of how the work is divided, because Everett goes to sea with his father to fish. Ada does the shore work with her mother. But except for small differences like that, they feel almost like they are the same person or two sides of one creature. And as the book progresses and as they move into adolescence, what comes between them is this growing sense of that they are becoming different people and almost strangers even to themselves. You know, that there are things happening to them that they don't understand and don't have the words even to try and express. And that becomes kind of a wedge that, they're never separated in the book.
Uh-huh.
And they never turn on each other in any way that's not repairable. But that is definitely the wedge that makes them realize that they are separate creatures in the world and that they're a mystery to themselves, let alone to the other person.
Is that because they're isolated, or is that just a natural progression, say, of relationships between siblings?
I mean, I think it would depend on the siblings. I know a lot of siblings do not feel that way, do not feel that close to each other. But I do know siblings who have experienced that sort of almost symbiotic relationship with their siblings if they're born close enough to them. And I think that's a natural progression then as they get older to start developing or just seeing the profound differences there are between them, and that forces them to reevaluate what that relationship is exactly. And in this case, of course, it's the burgeoning sexuality of the adolescent in particular that forces them to keep secrets from each other, which is something they had never done up to that point.
Right. We've talked already about how isolated they are. What do they know of, say, the wider world?
Almost nothing. And that's part of the... I thought of them almost as an Adam and Eve pair.
Uh-huh.
Because they are set up in the world, kind of, with a certain amount of knowledge, whatever they managed to glean from watching their parents for the first decade of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, though, once they're orphans, they are on their own to figure out what life is and how they fit into it. And, of course, up to that point, they have had almost no contact with the outside world. The only person that they've ever encountered from the outside world is the midwife, Mary Oram, who is this strange childlike figure who's bald and has no fingernails and kind of freaks them out. And for all they know, everybody outside the cove might be exactly like that.
Mm.
So ignorance they have of the outside world is part of the blindness that they have about how the world works and how they fit into it. And you know, in Genesis, that story of Adam and Eve, their innocence is explicitly presented as blindness. You know, it isn't until they eat from the tree of good of evil, that tree of knowledge, that they actually see that they're naked. And up to that point, it was something they were completely unaware of. And so the book, in a lot of ways, is following these two children as they go through a series of events where the scales come off their eyes and they see the world in a completely different way as they meet people from the outside world and as they change and develop as individuals and are forced to completely reevaluate who they are and where they are in the world and how they relate to it.
Are these things that you're thinking about in terms of your own life in the course of writing a book like The Innocents?
I think only in the sense that I think that all children, to one degree or another, go through the same process. So I kind of thought of them, of Ada and Everett, as stand-ins for all of us, really, and our own journey from that state of innocence that we have as children, that blindness we have to the adult world. Regardless of how much we know, there is that process of becoming different people as we grow older and trying to figure out what that means for us, and I think the older I get and the more books that I write, I'm increasingly drawn to the whole issue of the mystery at the heart of an individual's existence, and how much of a stranger we often are to even to ourselves, and what a lifelong process it is to know yourself. I was going to say completely, but I don't think that's something we ever get to.
Right.
But just to know ourselves enough to make peace with ourselves, they seem to me like individuals who would have to deal with that in an extremely, in an almost impossible situation.
Mm. And so do you find that with every book you write, there's something new that you learn about yourself, say? I mean, it's a hell of a way to make a living, you must admit.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I don't recommend it to anybody. And I was talking to someone else this morning, and I was saying that the only reason to write is because you can't not do it. Mm. Because there's just, I mean, I have been unbelievably lucky to find myself in the position I'm in, and I never expected ever to make money as a writer, and I certainly never expected to be able to do it full time. But I acknowledge that all that's happened for me is luck. You know, I know I have lots of friends who are writers who are better writers than me and have worked just as hard or harder than me who aren't in the position I'm in. And it is all about chance, it seems like, whether or not something works out. And I think that's a lesson that has definitely changed the kinds of things I'm writing about in the books as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, as you know, I'm reading the book, and there are things that I've been thinking about in terms of my own, say, growing up that I've never really thought about before.
Right.
And I can only imagine as you write a book like this, the same sort of introspection, if you will, same sort of debate that goes on in one's head as you're writing a book like this. I mean, that must be... I mean, it can be maddening if you're trying to finish a book, say, but I mean, it must be very valuable at the end of the day to have gone through the process of writing a book like this and coming through with some clarity, if you will, about your past.
Yeah. I certainly wasn't approaching this as an attempt to come to terms with my own childhood.
Sure.
But obviously, there's no way to separate those things either, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't really make this connection until recently, but I published a book of poetry called Under the Keel a number of years ago. And there's a section in there of poems about my childhood in my hometown. And what I realized when I started working on those poems was that although my memories of growing up are very vivid, and I would say that I have a fairly clear picture of what my childhood was like, when I was working on those poems, I realized that I had forgotten how that child felt.
Mm.
You know, all my feelings about my past were adult feelings that I'm pasting onto it.
Yeah.
And so writing those poems was an attempt to reconnect directly with the feelings that child had about what was happening to him. And that was a really useful exercise for trying to get inside the heads of these children in the novel, actually, and trying to see the world in the way that a child with their level of knowledge or lack of it would see it.
Now, this novel, like previous books of yours, is set in a time before your own.
Yeah.
In terms of going back, as you do, in your writing, I'm curious to know about this relationship that we have with history, and you know, I alluded to it earlier, in terms of how you research your books.
Right.
What is it about the past and writing novels set there, in terms of say how. I'm trying to ask about the connection between the past and the present, and so I'm trying to think. I mean, you obviously don't. I mean, you don't set out to write a book set in the past to explain today, do you?
No, I don't think so.
As one reads this book, I mean, it inevitably conjures thoughts of today, and so I'm wondering. I'm sure that's the case for a lot of readers of yours.
Right. I mean, I think I'm just trying to write stories that interest me, that I feel like will hold my attention for long enough to to allow me to finish the book. And I think what ends up happening is that the only stories that that convince me I'll be able to do that are stories that, even though they may be set in the past, have some kind of personal connection for me or have some connection to what I see going on in the world around me at the moment. And so although I'm writing stories set in the past, I think I'm almost always, in one way or another, writing about either myself or the world that I see around me. You know, it does not feel to me like escapism in the slightest. You know, it feels to me personally, as I'm writing, like a direct connection with the world I know, even though on the face of it, it may seem to be a completely different world I'm working with.
And so I guess when one looks back at history, I mean, the patterns are all there. I began the conversation talking about childhood. I mean, childhood for everybody is usually sort of the same thing, right?
Sure. Yeah, no, I agree.
And we all make the same mistakes, though, don't we? Even though we...
I think that's absolutely true. And in some ways, like in this particular case, what appealed about that story was how clean it was.
Mm.
So, I mean, if I tried to write a story similar to that set today, well, I'd have to deal with the internet and
right.
and pornography and sex education in schools and whatever else. And those would all be valuable things to deal with, but it would make the story far murkier as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And what appealed about these two kids alone in that cove was the barrenness, for lack of a better word, and how naked they were in that time and that place.
Yeah, and the thing that I was thinking about is, I mean, you know, I if I was in a situation like that and knowing what I know of, say, the wider world, I'd want to, you know, get out, right? And I'd want to, but then even though a lot of people think that, how many of us really get to do that, right?
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's a bit of a mystery why anybody stayed in Newfoundland. Other than the codfish, that was all that was there for Europeans.
Yeah.
But people did stay and continued to, you know, even though looking at it from the outside, it often doesn't look like a sensible course of action.
Michael, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you about this book, especially because it's one that I'm enjoying a great deal as it's released. All the best with it, and all the best with everything else. I guess you're working on another book now, are you?
No, I'm gonna rest on my laurels for a little while, such as they are.
Well, they should be significant because it's such an enjoyable book in many parts,
right.
and I'm sure. I'm like a lot of readers, just savoring. I mean, it's beautifully written, and I'm not patronizing when I say that. It's given one a lot to think about as one reads it.
Well, thanks, Joseph. I really appreciate that.
The book is called The Innocents. It is published by Doubleday. Michael Crummy joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.